During the last 9 weeks, we have been discussing different aspects of yoga, yoga philosophy, Vedanta, and related topics. Now, today I am going to discuss a very important topic: how the very concept of yoga came to be introduced into the Western world, especially America. Now, today, if you travel all over America, you find a number of yoga studios, yoga training centers established by a number of Eastern organizations. From the beginning of 20th century, you find Divine Life Society, and then Transcendental Meditation Group, and then many Chinese and other Eastern organizations started yoga training centers and meditation training centers. Now, do we really know who was actually responsible for this unique contribution to American culture? I'm coming to that subject. Well, at the very outset, I would tell you, for the first time in American history or in European history, yoga and Vedanta were introduced by a great Indian monk who came to America in 1893 to attend the Parliament of Religions at Chicago, Swami Vivekananda. He reached here during the middle of 1893, and he attended the famous Parliament of Religion in 1893, September 11, which was organized as part of the Columbian Exposition, the 400th year celebration anniversary of Columbus' discovery of America. Now, it was this monk who, for the first time in American history, introduced the concept of yoga and Vedanta and Vedantic transcendentalist ideas to America in a systematic, compact, traditional language. But I must tell you, even before Swamiji appeared here, Vedantic ideas had already started influencing American minds. So you find in the writings of Whitman, Thoreau, and Emerson. See, if you read the works of Whitman and Thoreau, you find so many references to Upanishads, often called Vedic philosophy. That's a term he uses, leaves of grass, Thoreau. Now, so there are many references. So Vedantic idea influenced the transcendentalist movement in America. But now I'm going to tell you how it really happened. As we know, the fundamental doctrines of Vedanta are expounded in the ancient Vedic scriptures, in the four Vedas, especially in the philosophical part of Vedic literature, which are known as Upanishads. Well, we have to think of a period somewhere between 4th or 5th millennium BC. Now, these ideas more or less remained confined to Sanskrit law, Sanskrit scriptures written in the old archaic Sanskrit language, till 1656. In 1656, 50 of these philosophical works, Upanishads, were translated into Persian language at the initiative of an Indian emperor who was actually a Muslim emperor, a very broad-minded person, Dara Shikoh, that was his name. He was the son, the eldest son of Jahangir. In fact, for this reason, the conservative clergy excommunicated him. They organized under his younger brother, and ultimately he was defeated in battle and he was killed treacherously by his younger brother Aurangzeb, who was a fanatic. Now, this great man, this prince Dara Shikoh, he invited about 20 2025 Sanskrit Scholars from Benares, Kashi, to his capital in Delhi. And then he requested them to translate 50 of these great Upanishad texts into Persian language. So that was how these ancient Sanskrit books came to be translated into a non-Indian language. Of course, we have to remember, even before that, even before Alexander's invasion of the East, Alexander invaded Persia and then Afghanistan, today's Afghanistan, right up to the northwestern borders of India. Even before that, there was close communication between Indian mystics and scholars in Damascus and Alexandria. So you find in the writings of Anaximandran, you find the writings of Thales, many of the ideas coming from Sankhya philosophy. You can find the traces of these ancient Indian philosophical ideas in the works of Thales. Thales belonged to 7th century BC. Yes, he's the first recorded well-known philosopher in Greek, in pre-Christian Greek philosophical tradition. Now, and he, according to him, water was the fundamental principle from which everything this world has evolved. So we are not going into those details. But Alexander's invasion took place 327 BC. Now, as I said earlier, in 1656 or 57, during this period, 50 of the Upanishadic texts were translated into Persian. Now, later on, in 1801, a great French scholar, Aquilin du Perrot, in this call, he translated many of these Upanishadic Vedantic texts from Persian into Latin. And this was actually the beginning of Vedantic influence or yogic influence in the Occidental, in the Western Hemisphere. So, Duperrot's translation of Upanishadic philosophy, philosophical texts, into Latin was read by a great German thinker, Schopenhauer. In those days, a German translation of Upanishads were not available. Schopenhauer, he was born about 1777, that's around 1800, that's in his life period. Schopenhauer. Now, Schopenhauer read these Upanishads in Latin version. A German translation was not available. And he was highly impressed. And I shall just quote one of his famous sentences in which he expressed what he felt when he read a Latin translation of the Upanishads. He said, "The most rewarding and the most elevating reading experience, with the exception of the original in Sanskrit," that is how he felt when he read these Upanishadic books. So, and he said, when some theologians argued with him, "Do you find in these Upanishads anything that you don't find the monotheistic religions, which project God as the creator of the world, who rewards and punishes humanity?" Then he said, "I have great regard for monotheistic religions, but ancient wisdom cannot be forgotten just because of what happened in Galilee." That was the reply, famous reply by Schopenhauer. He had respect for all traditions, but he had equal respect for traditions which came from outside his own inherited cultural values. That's the greatness of Schopenhauer. So, this is how it happened. And he was born in 1788 and passed away in 1860. But during his lifetime, a German translation of these Vedantic texts, yogic texts, had already appeared. And that was done, that transition was a small portion of these Upanishads were translated and published in some magazines by some German scholars, but not the whole text. For the first time, Upanishads were translated into German in 1882, after the passing away of Schopenhauer. He passed away in 1860. But Schopenhauer is said to have read some translations of parts of Upanishadic literature which appeared in some German magazines during his time. Now, for the first time, the whole Upanishadic texts were translated into German in 1882 by a great German scholar, Hendrik. That's his name. Hendrik. Von Hendrik, something like that. And the first English translation was done by Max Müller 2 years later, in 1884. When Swami Vivekananda traveled in Europe, he happened to meet Max Müller, and he had great admiration for this German savant who dedicated his whole life to study and contemplation of the Upanishadic philosophy. But then it is said that the best translation of the Upanishadic text into any European language was done by Paul Deussen, who translated these 50 Upanishads directly from Sanskrit into German. That was supposed to be a masterpiece of translation, classical translation work by Paul Deussen, who knew Sanskrit very well. Max Müller was not so much of a scholar in Sanskrit. He knew Sanskrit, but he could never come to India and study under traditional scholars in India. But Paul Deussen could do that. So that's a great contribution of Paul Deussen. Now, as I said earlier, Swami Vivekananda came here in 1893. And before he arrived here, America had already witnessed many intellectual movements initiated by Emerson, Thoreau, and others. So the American Transcendentalist movement, which started in the 1830s, 1840s, around that time, had already learned many things from Western philosophical tradition, not from Schopenhauer, and also from a great British poet like Keats, Shelley, who are all very much into Eastern transcendentalist ideas, you know. So when Swamiji came here, this was the intellectual atmosphere on the one hand. On the other hand, Swamiji had to face a big problem when he tried to interpret Eastern religion and Eastern philosophy in the Western world. Because religion and God had already acquired a very bad name during the later half of 19th century. And for that, I must go back to the early periods of European theology and European philosophy. So you find there's a great departure from Augustine time onwards in European history. See, Augustine was the great theologian belonging to 5th century AD who established some of the irrevocable fundamental doctrines of Christian theology. For example, the idea of inherited sin, because Adam, so the entire humanity inherits the sin, this idea. And also the total helplessness of man. Man is totally helpless. You are at the mercy of Almighty God. So man has no role at all to play except to take refuge at the feet of the Savior. Because the whole humanity has inherited sin because of Adam's act, you know, of eating the apple. You know. So from Augustine times onwards, what really happened, theology started exercising a most tyrannical influence on philosophy. Independent philosophy practically died in Europe right from Democritus' time, Plotinus' time onwards, in the 1st, 2nd century AD. Plotinus was the last great philosopher of the ancient Greek tradition. In ancient Greece, there were great thinkers who were independent thinkers, independent philosophers, who were seekers of truth, who believed that human being can exercise his reason, his intellect, and analyze, understand, and experience the truth. This, in fact, when Socrates taught this idea, Athenians could not tolerate it because he came too early for them. So there is an interesting dialogue which sometimes I quoted on another occasion. It's related to Socrates' last days. He was about to die. He was in the prison. He was accused of misleading the young generation of Athens. And then one of his followers and disciples, Crito, happened to visit him the early morning, the day he was to be executed. And somehow Crito managed to get permission to enter the prison because he was a prominent citizen, the city-state of Athens. So Crito put a question to Socrates. How shall we bury you? Then Socrates answered, before that you should catch the real me. So he meant the me, by real me, he meant something other than the body. As to body, you do to me what you do to other human bodies. As to real me, you should be able to catch the real me. He meant, I am something beyond this body, beyond this mind, beyond this intellect. I am something that transcends the psychophysical mechanism. I am an inner consciousness, Atman, not just physical body. Human beings are not just physical bodies. They come and go. But there is an inner spirit, inner consciousness, which in Sanskrit is called Atman, self or soul, within the human body, which is imperishable. You can never catch it. You cannot bury it because it is imperishable. The body is perishable. You do to my body what you do to other human bodies. But as to myself, you can never do anything to it. That's what Socrates said. And again you find the writings of Democritus and Plotinus, Neoplatonists, you know, he's the great exponent of Platonism. You find this influence of yoga and Vedanta philosophy in the writings of early Greek thinkers. But what happened during the Middle Ages, this trend came to an end, and dogmatism and theology started exercising a great influence on independent thought and independent philosophy. So independent philosophy practically vanished from Europe. From 18th century onwards, there was a revolt against the tyranny of theology, an attempt to exercise one's independent reason, one's right to think independently. On the one hand, you find German idealism, Kant and others, then British empiricism, Hume, Locke and others. And again, in 19th century, from Marx and Engels, there was another attempt to question the tyranny of theology over philosophy. So there was the Romantic revolt, empiricist revolt, humanist revolt, and ultimately, from the middle of 19th century, with the advent of Karl Marx and Engels, who together wrote Communist Manifesto and of course Das Kapital, there was an attempt to question the tyranny of theology and dogmatism over philosophy and independent thought. And along with that, Darwin's Origin of Species was published, which questioned the very concept of creationism. God created this world in 6 days, and the seventh day he took rest. So there was a lot of revolt, rebellion against the tyranny of dogmatism and theology over philosophy and independent thought. So as a revolt, as a response to all this, Europe and America witnessed many movements, many revolutionary movements, intellectual movements, of course, not violent revolutions, intellectual movements, to question the tyranny, the dictatorship of theology and dogmatism. Transcendentalist movement was one, Unitarian movement was another. Both were witnessed in America. And of course in Europe, there was a strong movement of socialism and communism and again evolutionism. It was during this period that Swami Vivekananda came to America in 1893. So as I said earlier, God and religion had got a bad name. People began to question that. According to many of the critics of religion in 19th century, there have been more wars, more battles fought in the name of God and on behalf of religion than on behalf of atheism. Of course, 19th century, when 20th century had witnessed Mao, Hitler and Joseph Stalin, that's a different matter. They fought and massacred and killed, not in the name of religion and God. But in 19th century, all the great historians and thinkers were referring to what happened during the Crusades and what happened during the 30 Years' War and many such events. You know, I'm not going into those details. 20th century, of course, had witnessed three great international, cosmic, eternal scourges of humanity who massacred people, not for religion or God, but in the name of atheism, of course. I'm not going into those details. Now, when Swami Vivekananda reached Chicago in 1893, there were many great thinkers in America and also Europe who were looking for a religion. We did not divide mankind into believers and non-believers. They were looking for a religion which did not conceive of God as somebody who sat above the clouds and supervised humanity, and who insisted that everyone should obey him. So they were looking for a different idea of God. Now, what was the religion Vivekananda introduced? Swami Vivekananda said, religion is not just faith, conviction, or doctrine, or dogma. Religion is experience. So one can experience spirituality even if you don't belong to any religion. Spirituality goes beyond religion. You can be spiritual without being religious. There have been many religious men who are spiritual, but there have been many religious men who were certainly not spiritual. So Swami Vivekananda defined religion as the manifestation of divinity already in man. So this sentence underlines a few important points. One, divinity is already within human beings. Divinity doesn't come from outside. We are already divine. I mean, God is a consciousness, supreme consciousness, Atman or the Self, which is immanent in all beings and also all-pervading, omnipresent and transcendent. God is not one who creates this world and divides mankind into conflicting groups of believers and non-believers, promising the believers with heaven and threatening the non-believers with eternal damnation. God is the immanent spirit, consciousness within. So when we realize, when we experience this inner divinity within, then we become better human beings, we become more compassionate. And our effort should be to manifest this divinity. For this, Vivekananda prescribed four methods: the path of selfless action, the path of meditation, the path of reasoning, and also the path of devotion. So monotheistic religions were accepted by Vivekananda. In fact, Vedanta accepts monotheistic religions, but it says that there is something beyond this. In Vedanta, there is no rejection of anything. Everything is accepted. Every path is accepted, not only tolerated, but accepted as equally valid paths leading to God. It's not that another religion is, you can coexist with another religious tradition. No, every religion, if the seeker is sincere and honest, can take him to the supreme spiritual experience. One should be sincere, honest, lead a pure life, should lead a life of unselfishness, purity and compassion, and spiritual brotherhoods. So Vivekananda's concept of religion was based on this universalism. universalism in approach. It has got two dimensions. On the one hand, everything in this world is permitted by the Divine Spirit. The Divine Spirit is the immanent reality within every living being. And it is also the omnipresent or pervading reality. So as we realize this inner divinity within, we move closer to God, we become really spiritual, and simultaneously we start looking upon entire humanity as one spiritual family. There is no otherness in spirituality. So even non-believers, atheists have a place in spiritual life, in God's empire. Because God is not one that creates this world and stays away from it. God is the inner spirit, the consciousness, Atman, residing in all living beings. You can never hate a single living being in this world and be spiritual. You can never look upon anybody as other than yourself and be spiritual. So Vivekananda said, there is a religion beyond religions. Religion is capital letter R, beyond all religions, which is based on the inner experience within. And for that, as I said earlier, he prescribed four paths, which are four yogas. So the path of disinterested action, unselfish action, is called Karma Yoga. The path of devotion is called Bhakti Yoga. The path of rational thinking is called Jnana Yoga. And the path of meditation is called Raj Yoga. These ideas are found in all religious traditions. Vivekananda said, in all religious traditions, in the teachings of the great prophets and thinkers and founders of religion, you find this universal, spiritual, humanistic ideas. But very often, you know what happens? These ideas are forgotten. In all religions, in all religious traditions, these universal, spiritual, humanistic ideas constitute the very core of religion, the very core of spirituality. But there are other aspects, geographical, cultural, sociological, anthropological. So you find when a religious teacher preaches or teaches, he has to use the metaphor, the language of the culture into which he is born. So the way of thinking and then the style and the similes, the examples, the analogies, all will be borrowed from his own or her own cultural tradition. So geography plays a very important role in the interpretation of religious traditions. But Vivekananda says that very often we forget these fundamental spiritual principles of humanism, compassion, universalism, which are found in all religious doctrines and books. And instead, we give more importance to the cultural, the anthropological, the sociological aspects, which can never be universal. Because at the cultural level, geographical level, there can be no uniformity. You find that each nation, each geographical region in the world has developed its own cultural traditions, languages, ways of thinking, and sociological, anthropological customs and habits. There can be no unity. But there is unity with regard to the fundamental principles of spiritual life, which is universalism, accepting the other man's view as sacred as our own. So pluralism becomes something that is acceptable. You can welcome pluralism because behind the pluralism, behind the diversity, there is the undercurrent of unity based on spiritual experience. So you find Vivekananda's teachings, there is a very interesting description of how we evolve along the path of spiritual life. He says, at the beginning, you know, there is diversity with regard to customs and habits and rituals. See, you may, one of us may go to a church, another person may go to a temple, a third one may go to a synagogue, another person may go to a mosque, and so on. There can be no unity because And all these customs and habits are related to the geographical and cultural diversity, which again is related to the way in which these ideas were preached by the founders of religion. Because they're born into different geographical and cultural traditions. So they had to use those similes and metaphor and language. So there can be no unity. There is bound to be diversity with regard to customs and habits and rituals. But as we go higher, as we move further, we find there is mythology. So you find, for example, Iliad is very close to Valmiki Ramayana. There's a lot of similarity. Iliad is Homer's famous book, you know, it's very famous. Very, very, very similar. Many ideas. So in the writings of Homer, in the writings of Virgil, you find many ideas which are very common to Indian mythological works. Ramayana, Mahabharata, and so on. There are some common factors, but there is still a lot of diversity. No unity. So there can be no unity at the level of mythology or rituals. But when the third stage is philosophy, as we move further to a higher level, from ritual we move to mythology, from mythology we move still higher to philosophy. When it comes to philosophy, you find there are many common doctrines and ideas and principles which are found in all religious traditions. Yoga and Vedanta and Christianity, Islam, Sufism, and everywhere we find many common ideas philosophically, from the philosophical point of view. See, there are many common principles, ontological ideas, the study of the fundamental being, you know, the origin of the universe. Especially with regard to ontological ideas, there are many common factors, and also epistemology, perception, inference, comparison, presumption, and so on, mind you. So there could be many common factors when it comes to philosophy, but still there is a lot of diversity. Doctrines can never be the same because of the geographical, the cultural, and the anthropological diversity. But these three constitute only the outer shell of religion. These three factors, I mean, rituals, mythology, and philosophy, they do not constitute the whole of the core of religious or spiritual tradition, spiritual life. Vivekananda says the core of spiritual life, religious life, is experience. And when you come to experience, you find there is perfect unity and harmony and synthesis in all religious traditions. Because all the great religious mystics were extremely humane, compassionate, and very universal. As they became more and more pure within, they became more and more universal and broad-minded in their attitude towards other human beings around the world. And at the highest peak of experience, they could look upon the entire humanity as one spiritual family. So you cannot hurt your neighbor, not because God will punish you, but because your neighbor is not different from yourself. Because by hurting your neighbor, you are hurting yourself. So this universalism was the very core of what Vivekananda taught in America in 1893. Now, interestingly, I shall just try to give you a glimpse of how Vivekananda's philosophical ideas, spiritual ideas, evolved. Vivekananda was born at a time when the works of Marx and Engels had already were becoming popular among the elite of the big cities in the world, in Britain, India, America, etc. Not political ideas, mind you, philosophical ideas, humanistic ideas. They were looked upon as humanist, not as political ideologies in the early days. And Darwin's challenge against creationism had already started shaking the foundations of established doctrines and dogmas and theology. And modern discoveries in the later half of 19th century had already started questioning some of the age-old beliefs, customs of religions, organized religions. And Vivekananda was born in a city where the Unitarian Church had a large following, because he belonged to a reformist movement called Brahma Samaj, which was founded in 1828 by a great Indian reformer, Rajaramohan Roy. So Vivekananda belonged to this reformist movement, which had borrowed many ideas from Unitarian teachings, universal ideas. So at the same time, he had already studied the classical works of Sanskrit, classical works of Vedanta and yoga in Sanskrit language. And along with that, he had also the unique privilege of sitting at the feet of a great spiritual teacher of 19th century India, Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, who was his spiritual teacher. He could learn, he could sit at his feet for 5 years and learn from him the essence of what spirituality is all about. Spirituality is experience. Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa was not a philosopher in the academic sense, but he was a philosopher for excellence in another sense, because he had already realized the essence of the philosophical ideas of different religious traditions. So Vivekananda could learn from his own master, his own teacher, the essence of what religion really means. So that is why he later defined religion as experience, as spirituality, as the manifestation of divinity already in man. I think it was Vivekananda who gave this unique definition to the Western academic world. Religion is not belief. Belief goes only skin deep. Anyone can proclaim, I believe in this and that. And belief can be negated by disbelief. The belief is something purely intellectual. You can believe in something, and after some time somebody may argue about that subject, and you may start disbelieving it. But experience can never be negated. And Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, Vivekananda's guru and teacher, had taught and expounded all the spiritual truths based on his own inner spiritual experience. Vivekananda himself was something of an agnostic, who was not willing to believe in the popular religious traditions. When he started going to his teacher, he questioned his teacher. But his teacher didn't mind. So that means even an agnostic, a non-believer, or somebody who thinks that God cannot be known, can become spiritual. So Swami Vivekananda defined religion as experience, as a manifestation of divinity already in man, and not as a set of customs, habits, rituals and philosophical doctrines or beliefs or belief systems. So this idea was based on the ancient philosophical works known as Upanishads. Now I am coming to yoga. Now, you know, yoga, which is becoming popular nowadays, called Hatha Yoga, physical exercise, is just one aspect, not a very important aspect, one insignificant aspect of the real yoga philosophy. Yoga, the Bible of yoga philosophy is called Patanjali's Yoga Shastra, was written by the great teacher Patanjali, who may have believed around most probably 1200 BC. There are different views among historians about the period in which he lived, but in a conservative way we can say he belongs to around 1200 BC. There are different views among historians, you know, but they never wrote their own autobiography, and nobody wrote their biography, I think. So that's a difficulty, you know, often shrouded in mystery, you know. But it is said that analyzing on the basis of certain historical principles, like in historiography, for example, the historical concordance, the references to yoga practices and yoga system of philosophy found in the writings of early travelers who traveled to India from Alexandria, Damascus and other places. So this is the way, 1200 BC. Now, he wrote a book which is which consists of small pithy statements, just not one full sentence, maybe half a line. It's called Sutra. It's not a full sentence, something it may be called a series of phrases, small phrases. And he wrote innumerable such sutras. Only one sutra is dedicated to the physical exercise part of yoga. It's called Hatha Yoga. You can imagine, there are scores of sutras, hundreds, in which only one sutra is devoted to the yoga philosophy. Sorry, the yoga exercise that is becoming popular nowadays, physical part. And this exercise system is meant to enable you to sit quiet for a long time in a steady manner for meditation. That will help you to go beyond the body. It is not just to make your body strong. It is meant to make your body strong so that you will not complain against about your body. Body will not become sick, because sickness will be an obstacle in spiritual path. If you are sick, you will not be able to sit quiet for a long time and meditate. So your body should be perfect and fit. Therefore, a few exercises are required. For that, Patanjali prescribed a few methods. And this is the one. Now, okay. So Patanjali wrote this book, and it was commented upon by several thinkers, several philosophers. But in later centuries, the physical exercise part was elaborated by some scholars, and the spiritual philosophical aspects were elaborated by a large number of philosophers and thinkers and scholars. Now, Vivekananda gave altogether a new dimension, a new meaning to the very concept of yoga. According to him, yoga is the path that takes you to freedom. Just as physical exercise will help you to gain freedom from physical ailments. Similarly, the true practice of yoga will take you to a spiritual freedom. That's how Vivekananda defined yoga. Yoga is a path that leads you to freedom. Freedom from the tyranny of the senses. We have to live in this world, but we should know that the world and worldly achievements cannot give us eternal peace, happiness. It may give you freedom from poverty. When you become rich, you get freedom from poverty. When you become well known, then it gives you freedom from your desire for popularity. That's all. So it gives you freedom, but freedom at the relative level. The absolute spiritual freedom is the goal of yoga, according to Swami Vivekananda. In fact, Vedanta constitutes the essence of the central theme of yoga philosophy. Because the idea of going beyond, the idea that there is something beyond what I see around me, the present, the empirical, the worldly pleasures, there is something beyond, is possible. This idea it comes to you only when you stand outside the instinctive evolution. See, the evolution is like a flow. Animals do not think about the transcendental things. Animals are happy when they get food, a shelter, perhaps, that's all. Nothing more. But there is something which only human beings can do. Stand outside this flow of evolution and ask the question, what's the meaning of my life? Where am I heading for? What is the real significance of life? What's the meaning of this world? Where does it come from? These higher ideas are possible only for human beings. In fact, every human being at one time or other thinks all these ideas. But what happens when you, when we get a blow from our, from circumstances, we stop for a moment, but again we forget and we join the natural stream of life. We forget. But great thinkers and philosophers, they pursue this path of inquiry. And they have made several attempts. And ultimately, the great Indian sages discovered that absolute freedom or real freedom is possible only when we can get freedom from the tyranny of the five senses of perception and the five senses of action, which drag our mind towards external objects. So long as we are slaves of our senses, we have no freedom. So if you give full freedom to your senses, it leads to spiritual slavery. But if you can control your senses with your mind, then it leads to spiritual liberation. So there is a famous, I already referred to this, there is a famous imagery in the Kathopanishad, you know, imagery of a charioteer. So whole life is compared to a journey in a chariot. The horses are our senses of perception, senses of action. The reins with which we control the horses is the mind. And the driver of the chariot is intellect. And the owner of the chariot is self, Atman. Now, if you really want to reach your destination, you should be very careful while controlling the horses. If you don't control the horses with the reins properly, then perhaps the horses may take you over a precipice and that will lead to destruction. But on the other hand, if you have the power of discrimination, the discerning mind, if you have a discerning mind, then with the help of that discerning mind, you can control the horses. Then horses will take you to the destination where you want to go. And where do we want to go? We want to live in this world, but we want to be different from animals. Everybody wants to be different from animals, you know. So in fact, an artist who spends his whole lifetime for drawing, or a musician who spends his whole lifetime, who dedicates his whole lifetime to music, or a literary genius who spends his whole lifetime for literary pursuits, they are all trying to seek freedom. But they are able to get only relative freedom, not spiritual freedom. See, Dostoevsky was supposed to be the greatest novelist the world has ever seen. Brothers of Karamazov is the most unrivaled literary masterpiece. But he wrote it when he was fully drunk, vodka, under the power of vodka. So it is said. But the man was a marvelous genius. So you find many great literary geniuses, artists, musicians, and there have been many musicians who had a glimpse of spirituality, where music itself became a path leading to music. So also literature, the great literature, there have been many literary geniuses for whom literature became a path leading to spiritual freedom. I shall just give you a glimpse into the life of the poet who wrote the first work in Sanskrit language, maybe about third millennium BC. His name was Valmiki, and the literary classic is Ramayana. Well, it may be around four or five times the size of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey put together. It's a huge book, not as big as Mahabharata, smaller, but still quite huge. The story is very similar to Iliad. There are, of course, I'm not going into those details. Now, this Valmiki, he was a robber who used to waylay innocent people assault them and rope them. He was practically a very violent robber. So once it so happened that he was waiting somewhere in a street looking for his victims. And then a group of saints and sages were going that way. They were walking along the same road. So this man thought, well, these poor fellows, I can get from them. So he tried to rob them because he was armed and they were not. Now, one of them calmly asked him a question. Well, we will give you whatever we want. Whatever we have, we are ready to hand over to you. Don't take any extra trouble to rob us. We are ready to give you whatever you want. But before that, one question. Do you know for whose sake are you doing this evil deed? Who is going to be benefited by this evil deed that you are doing, robbing and killing people? He said, well, I am an householder, I have my family and children, I have to support them. Then they asked him a question. Now look here, you are always engaged in these evil deeds, robbing people, doing evil things. Do you know you are committing sins? You may have to pay for this. You may have to suffer. After your death, you may have to suffer for your evil deeds. You said you are robbing to support your family. Do you think your family members will suffer on your behalf? Or you have to do it yourself? The robber said, I should go home and ask this. I ask my wife and children and mother and the other relations. Meanwhile, you should stay here, don't go anywhere. They said, we'll give you the word, we promise you, we'll remain here. You go to your home and put this question to your wife, children and others. I am a robber. Do you know I am a robber? Do you know how I am making money? I am bringing money for you, bringing food for you. They were surprised when this fellow said that he is a professional robber. Every day he is robbing people. That's how he is supporting them. It was a shocking news to them. Then they were terribly angry. You evil fellow, you get out. Then that fellow got angry with them. No, what? I have been doing all these evil things, evil deeds to support you. So you should go to hell on my behalf. They say I will have to suffer, I will go to hell for my evil deeds. But I was doing all this for your sake. Now you should share my sufferings. This, no, we can't share. You have to suffer. For you have to suffer the consequences of your evil deeds. And this man was he was shocked. And he came and fell at the feet of the sages and asked for forgiveness. The sages said, all right. He was completely transformed. They gave him one sacred holy name. Because he was such an evil man, he could not utter even that holy name properly. Somehow they gave the inverted form of the name. But he could not, because he was such an evil man. He could not bring his mind to the level of uttering a sacred mantra, a holy name. But somehow this man was so persistent, very sincere, though very wicked. And he promised, well, I shall repeat this name. They told him, you remain here, you stay in this place, you remain here, uttering this sacred name with great devotion and concentration till we return after some time. And they went their way. After many years they returned. They found an anthill. Nobody else. They understood that this man was as good as his word. And they broke the anthill. They found this man sitting within. He had become almost a skeleton and with great devotion and concentration, uttering the sacred mantra with holy name which they had given him, instructed him some years back. He had become a saint. Now, he was the author of the first great classical work in Sanskrit literature. So, you can see that sudden transformation. So, concentration, dedication, will enable any true spiritual seeker to start a new life any day, any moment. See, even a little bit of practice of this yoga or Vedantic ideal can help us, because according to yoga and Vedanta, life is not one, it is eternal. Even if a little bit of spirituality, concentration, meditation, or holy thought that we do in this life will remain in our account, and in our next life, we will be able to continue our spiritual journey from where we have left it in this life. So, I have just given you just a very short span of time, given you a brief account of how Swami Vivekananda brought this great yoga ideal to the Western Hemisphere. And he, along with that, he gave us a new paradigm of not only religion or religious thought, but a new paradigm in life. Because universality, compassion, and the ideal of unity of existence, the idea that all religions are equally valid parts leading to goal, leading to the supreme goal. And the essence of religion is not just belief or conviction, but in the inner experience which transforms us, which makes us more human, more compassionate, and which enables us to look upon an entire humanity as our own spiritual family. These are the new ideas which Swamiji brought to the Western world. But we have to remember, these ideas already existed in the ancient Vedic and Vedantic scriptures. These ideas are found in the early, in the teachings of the great sages of ancient times. But it was Vivekananda's glory that he brought it to the Western world, and he interpreted and expounded it in a language and a style which anyone living in modern times, in the post-industrial world, can understand. Because he said, religion is not anti-humanistic. Religion is the greatest philosophy of humanism, because it is philosophy of spiritual humanism, looking upon entire humanity as one spiritual family. It is not against science or technology. You need not blindly believe in anything. You try to experiment and reach the inner experience yourself. So you need not believe blindly. And again, it is universal. It is humanistic. It is rational. It doesn't ask us to stop thinking or stop questioning. We are given the freedom to think and question, and ultimately realize this ideal ourselves. This is the essence of his teachings. So now we'll have interaction for about 25 minutes. Okay. Any doubts, questions, or points for discussion, you can.
Yes. This is what I want to say, I'm sure, before I ask my question or make my comment. I know everyone here has really enjoyed all this series of satsanga. It's been very, I think we all benefited a lot, and I know that myself I have. But I have some things about animals.
Animals, yeah.
Animals. Well, first of all, one man, he's, I don't think he's here now, he asked you a question, which you did answer, actually. You said, he asked a question, can animals, I don't think he said obtain moksha, but what level animals can go in the realization of the divine consciousness? Well, recently I heard somebody read the Narayana Sutra, and they also translated that, and in that it says, all creatures can realize Narayana. So, in your saying that you said all along, that all creatures have the divine consciousness, are part of the divine consciousness. So it means that, how do we know, like, it isn't that animals are thinking or anything, they already know who they are. They're not like us asking, why are we here and what are we doing? They're, in some ways, they're beyond us. They already know what they're doing until they're interviewed with by human beings. Mm-hmm. They're already doing it, and they already... My experience is that some creatures that I had interacted with, they know what they are, and they know that they're part of the divine consciousness, which not hardly anyone has really realized that, human beings. So my point is that we may be differentiated from other creatures besides human beings that we can contemplate on the nature of reality and think about the divine consciousness and what we're doing here and so on. But my argument is that they already know that. So are we really... You said, oh, you just made a statement. You said, do we want to be like animals? But animals didn't do what we've done to the earth.
Yes.
I think that they didn't. We did this mess here, okay? And it might be beautiful, and it might be horrible,
yes.
But they didn't do it. So that's my...
And true info. No, only human beings can do good things consciously and also evil things consciously.
But I think so.
Animal, but when I use the word animal, what I mean, animals cannot consciously make an effort to speed up their evolution. I don't mean physical evolution. Spiritual or cultural evolution.
They're here, they're in their place, and they're doing their...
But animals who live in close association with advanced spiritual personalities sometimes instinctively imbibe many of these qualities, maybe not consciously, but unconsciously. But according to yoga and Vedanta, and the whole creation belongs to different levels of evolution, of manifestation of this divinity within. So, you know, Vivekananda made this great statement, the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha. Buddha in Sanskrit means the enlightened one, is one of degrees, not of kind. So, all the beings, all the living beings belong to different levels of manifesting this inner divinity. That's the idea behind. So, but one, from a superficial point of view, we can say animals do not deliberately do anything evil, but they also cannot consciously go and meditate or pray or read sacred scripture. They can't do. So only human beings can make a conscious effort to...
Yeah, of course. I don't have any argument with you at all.
That's
however,
true.
Whether it makes us better or worse, and I don't agree that animals can't... I mean, I have my personal... personal experience is that some animals are more profound than human beings.
That's
and
true.
That they do...
That's true.
They do... I mean, maybe they aren't contemplating the nature of reality... Yeah.
Yes.
But there's something about them where they understand the nature of reality.
Yes,
and they can teach it to you. But,
yes.
You know, Dattatreya, he learned so many things from animals. And in the Ramayana, at least in Tulasidas Ramayana, it's an enlightened crow who's telling the story to the eagle.
Yes. Exactly. Panchakarta. Yeah. Even if you analyze their skill, see, you think of the size of honeybees and you think of the intricate architectural marvel they are creating.
Yes,
the highly organized life of the ant world, you find that. So they have their own subtle modes of communication, organization, doing things. But what I meant was that only human beings can make a conscious effort to to speed up the spiritual evolution.
Yeah, that's right. No, I don't have an argument with you about that.
Thank you.
The Indian tradition throughout the history had disputes as to this sect, this commentary, on and on. And the Indian tradition, just like any other world tradition, had all of these controversies.
True.
And I'm struck, especially at the culmination of these wonderful lectures, about Vivekananda's contribution to say... Forget it. That's not the core essence. And I just am struck again from your lecture how revolutionary that really is.
Ah, really, yes. From Western point of view, a definition of religion like this, see, religion is not just belief or dogmas. Religion goes beyond books and temples and churches and places of worship and priestcraft. It is something related to our own inner experience, which everyone can reach. And that experience is beyond explanation, beyond description, beyond words. So it was altogether revolutionary from a Western point of view. But we have to remember at the same time, these ideas are already found in the works of Upanishads and Shankaracharya and other great thinkers. I shall give one example. But very correctly you made this statement. In Indian history, even now you find a lot of controversies and conflicts. You know, 1.1 billion population living in an area which is just about one third of the United States. You can just imagine, and it existed like that for the last 6,000 years, 7,000 years. Okay, now I'm coming to another point. You know, Vivekananda refers to this phenomenon in the first Chicago lecture. I thank you in the name of the mother of religions, which gave shelter to the Israelites who went away from Israel. In 54 or 52 AD, when the Jewish temple was destroyed, not by Romans. Roman attack took place later, Assyrians perhaps. Romans invaded the Masada in 71 AD. So, when the ancient Jewish synagogue was destroyed in Jerusalem, they migrated to India. And when they reached India, the local Hindu king did not know anything about their religion, these people. But they wanted a place where they could practice their religion. So what he did, he just handed over the temple, an ancient Hindu temple, to them. There you do whatever you want, you can convert this to your place. He was given full freedom. That place was destroyed by the Portuguese in the 16th century, 1514, the Portuguese traders, because they were Catholics,
right.
They were persecutors. And later that synagogue was rebuilt by the Hindu Raja, who drove away the Portuguese. The Portuguese started persecution of the old Christians who were living in India at that time. And again, almost 52 AD, it is said that a group of Christians migrated from Syria under St. Thomas, one of the disciples. Now, this is sometimes disputed, but there is no doubt that a group of Christians did arrive in India in the later half of 3rd or 2nd century AD. According to traditional belief, they came in 52 AD, but that is often disputed. May be true, may not be, but there is no doubt that the first settlement of Christians came in the beginning of 3rd century AD. And again, you know, Parsis in Iran, for example. In the 7th century AD, Iran was overrun by the Arabs, and the followers of Zarathustra, Parsi religion, they ran away. When they came to India, a very interesting incident took place. They reached the Gujarat coast, northwestern coast. So they had brought with them a cauldron of burning fire, because they were fire worshippers. So the king gave them a place to worship, gave some villages and handed over to them a temple where they could worship. They can convert that place into their own temple or whatever it is. Then the king wanted to test the priest. What contribution will you make to my kingdom? Then the priest, the Parsi priest, asked the king, could you get me a vessel full of milk? So it was brought. Then the Parsi priest took a morsel of sugar from his bag and put in that milk and stirred it. This is what we are going to do for you. We are going to enrich your culture, tradition, whatever it is. It's a very interesting story. It's a very famous incident that took place in the 7th century AD. Now, what I'm trying to drive home is, if you go to an Indian village even today, if you go to a conservative, traditional, orthodox Vedic scholar who may not know anything about Christianity, Judaism, Islam, or any other non-Indian religious traditions, if you tell them, we also, oh, that is also a path leading to God. They do not know, they have not participated in any interreligious, interfaith conference or anything. They don't know anything about other religion. Anybody who is sincerely following a path, and if that person is sincere, then it is God's business to look after them, not our business. You know? Because if a seeker is sincere and honest and pure, then God's door is open before him. For that you don't have some, God won't seek anybody's permission. May open the doors before him. God does it himself. So spirituality is a direct communication between you and God in a monotheistic language, or in non-dualistic language, it is the realization of the divinity already within you. You can be monotheist, you can follow any path, and you can have your own concept of absolute reality in the form of a God with form, name, etc. But if you're sincere and honest, then that absolute reality will reveal its true nature to you. Not because you're following any particular path, but because you're pure and sincere and honest. That's the condition. God looks into your heart, not into the type of rituals that you're following. That's the idea behind it. See? That's the idea. We have just about 10 minutes more, if you have anything. Otherwise, we'll conclude and we won't stop this session. We'll continue after some time where you can contact Vedanta Society. You can look at our website from time to time. We'll have more functions in future. Right. So, shall we conclude? Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tatsat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu. Om Peace Peace Peace.